From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts State Police track the license plates of all vehicles that enter or leave Cape Cod. Where should we draw the line between privacy and public safety?
In the world we live in right now, people have very little privacy to begin with. You know, if it's abused, then that certainly can be a problem, but it can also be a very effective tool when utilized the right way.
Plus, could electric currents improve the working memories of older adults?
A working memory performance in these older individuals, in fact, boost it so great that they were now comparable in terms of their working memory performance to the 20-year-olds.
And we go live to Fenway Park for the Red Sox home opener.
If they don't win, it's a shame, for it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball.
That's next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Take me out to the ball game.
Take me out with the crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and crackers.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. And yes, it's opening day at Fenway Park as Boston police officers Kim Tavares and Stephen McNulty sing us into the baseball spirit. Today's chilly conditions may make the old ballpark feel like it did in October, but the Sox sure aren't playing like they did last fall when they won the World Series. In fact, the Sox have just 3 wins and 8 losses after a disappointing road trip to start the season. So, can they turn it around today for the home crowd? Joining me now from Fenway is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to try not to chatter through this segment too much.
Yeah, I saw the hat you had on earlier. You were ready. You were bundled up. It does not look like spring baseball weather, but let's get to the important stuff.
You got the layers on.
You got the layers. Are we winning, Shira? I mean, are we going to get off the schneid here? How's it going?
I don't know. We're tied right now in the top of the fourth. So the answer is no, we're not winning. But we're not losing either. Yes.
We could
be in a few innings. So, you know, give it time.
Give it time. All right. In all seriousness, though, let's set aside the wins and losses for a moment.
And that goes for the season, too. Give it time.
Right. Well, it is just one on the ledger. It's one out of 162 games. But, of course, opening day at Fenway has more significance to Boston than just one game. So what's the atmosphere like?
Yeah, especially this year because it was, you know, the time that the Red Sox team from 2018 got their ring. So this was a big ceremony before the game. You know, they had the Patriots, the Super Bowl champion Patriots, throw out the first pitch, and then the players got their rings. And, I mean, it was just a lot of festivities. It was an hour's worth of festivities before you actually got to the start of the game today because of last year's World Series championship.
And a lot of hardware on display, right, Shira? If I was doing my math right, I was trying to keep track as I was watching the tape between the World Series and Lombardi trophies. I think there were 10 out there. It was very impressive.
Yes, it was very impressive. Yes, trophies all over the place, you know, all-stars all over the place, MVPs all over the place, past players coming back. You know, you had David Ortiz and even Curt Schilling was here. I think I saw Manny Ramirez, too. So got action. Oh, we got an out, so things are good. Sorry, you know. Things are happening here. An incredible ceremony. They always do ceremonies incredibly well here. And then the team went out to the center field flagpole to raise the 2018 championship banner, which was a great scene.
That's great. So I assume that loud out we heard recorded was recorded by Chris Sale, but he hasn't been pitching very well to start this season, Shira, even though he pitched very well for the Sox in the playoffs in the fall. So how'd he look today?
If you had asked me before the third inning, I would have said he looks great. You know, he had kept the Toronto Blue Jays scoreless, but then he allowed 2 runs in the third. So now the score is tied 2-2. I'm just impressed that he's out there in short sleeves because it is so cold. But he has not looked great, and now there is a meeting on the mound. We'll see what's happening here. Not looked great. And part of that may be that during spring training, Alex Cora, you know, wanted to, you know, because it was such a long season last year with the World Series championship, Alex Cora wanted to sort of preserve his pitchers a little bit and didn't have them playing and pitching in as many games as you might ordinarily with your starting staff, with the idea being we're playing for October baseball and we want, you know, our players well-rested for that stretch run, that playoff run. So they may be a little bit behind the eight ball, so to speak, in terms of where they would like to be at the start of the season. But now we're having a meeting on the mound, and let's see what happens here.
Well, you mentioned the long season, Shira, and it's hard to complain about that when they actually win the whole thing. But there is a World Series hangover sometimes. I mean, when there's a lot of wear and tear on a pitcher's arm and other players. I mean, is that what's behind the early season struggles for Sale and the rest of the team, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's behind the World Series hangover is the fact that the teams that make the World Series, and then, you know, the team obviously that wins the World Series, you know, they're playing a month later than all the other teams. And also the pitchers are putting in 20, 25 more innings, you know, the starting pitchers are, than they would ordinarily. Then their off season, when they would be resting and recovering, is that much shorter. So, I mean, there's a physiological reason behind the the known World Series hangover. It's not just a mental thing as well.
I want to ask you about another player in particular, Shira, and that's Dustin Pedroia. He is in the lineup today for the first time this season, but fans hardly saw him play last season either. So can you remind us what he's coming back from? How important is he still to this team?
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of the heart of the team. He's certainly a fan favorite, but really the heart of this team in many ways. You're right. He played in just three games, I believe, last season. I think those games were at the end of last May. He is returning from multiple surgeries on his left knee. After that very brief return last May, he had another procedure to remove some scar tissue in his knee. But he was so well received here when he came up to bat. I believe it was in the second inning. He got a standing ovation. Unfortunately, he hit into a double play, but clearly everybody is happy to see him back. And I think no one happier to be back, obviously, than Dustin Pedroia, who just looks like a young kid out there. So excited to be back playing. I don't know if he'll be an everyday player like he has been in the past, but just excited to be past that knee injury.
Okay, one other thing I'm wondering, Shira, have you seen any blown calls yet today? And I'm asking because Boston University researchers recently analyzed 4 million pitches from the past 11 seasons, so big sample size, and they found that Major League umpires call balls and strikes wrong 20% of the time. That's one in every 5 pitches. Not a great look for the league there, Shira, and I know that's something you've been focusing on for a while. So would the data actually change anything here? I mean, could we see robot umpires or something?
So, first of all, no blown calls yet, but like everything today, give it time. So you never know what's going to come in the innings ahead. Chances are there will be some controversial call, especially given the statistics you just mentioned. So will this change the way baseball looks at umpiring? I would have to say that this study just adds evidence to what Major League Baseball already knows and what fans, of course, already know, that it's an imperfect umpiring system and something needs to be done. One of the interesting things that was happening even before this study came out is that MLB has partnered with the Independent Atlantic League, and they are trying what's being called robot umpires. So home plate umpires there are being assisted in calling balls and strikes by a TrackMan radar tracking system. Basically, it helps them better judge what's in the strike zone and what's outside the strike zone. So it's very clear that Major League Baseball is trying to figure out how to make the ball and strike calls better and seeing if technology might be the ultimate solution.
Interesting. All right, Shira Springer, stay warm. Keep us posted. We look forward to seeing recap and hopefully bring us a win.
Yes, still tied, by the way.
All right, still tied. That's WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. As President Trump looks to clamp down on asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border, the Boston City Council is considering strengthening protections for undocumented people here. They're looking to bolster the city's Trust Act after multiple reports by WBUR's Shannon Dooling showed that Boston police worked with federal immigration officials in arresting an undocumented construction worker. City councilors questioned Boston Police Commissioner William Gross at a hearing today, and Shannon was there. Shannon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Callum.
So remind us why this hearing was called today in the context of your own reporting.
Right. So Councilman Josh Zakim called the hearing and began today by saying he wanted to talk about how the city's Trust Act can be strengthened. He sponsored that Trust Act back in 2014. It was passed, and you'll recall it prohibits Boston police from detaining undocumented immigrants solely at the request of ICE. Right. Other cities refer to similar policies as so-called sanctuary city policies. And interestingly, Zakim placed the hearing today within the broader national immigration debate. Let's take a listen.
This president has just, you know, done a purge of his Homeland Security Department because they're not tough enough on immigration. And that is going to be felt, you know, in cities like Boston. Right. So this is as much about preparing for the future.
As much about preparing for the future as it is about this particular incident he had concerns about. So Zeka mentioned our reporting here at WBUR served as the catalyst for the hearing today, particularly the case of Jose Martin Paz Flores, who was arrested in 2017 by immigration officials after leaving a meeting at Terra Construction. Paz Flores, who at the time was working without documentation, had just filed a workers' comp claim after falling from a ladder on a job site.
I see. So even though Zeka was trying to sort of broaden the conversation, did the council dive into the particulars of the Paz Flores case today?
They absolutely did. Exactly. So they wanted a sort of play-by-play from Commissioner Gross and Sergeant Detective Gregory Gallagher, who our reporting showed is the BPD's sort of designated liaison with ICE officials. And they got just that. Gallagher described how he communicated with Terra Construction officials in trying to verify Paz Flores' actual identity. Now, Paz Flores had worked for Terra Construction for years at this point, and it wasn't until his workers' comp claim that the CEO of Terra Construction, Pedro Perez, called up his cousin, who happens to be a detective on the Boston Police Force, and asked for his help in verifying Paz Flores' identity. Paz Flores, it came to Boston Police's attention, did have a civil immigration warrant from ICE. And Gallagher confirmed today that he communicated with both the construction company and with ICE officials and actually coordinated the timing of Paz Flores' arrest by ICE in 2017. And this was a real sticking point for Councilwoman Lydia Edwards, who repeatedly asked Gross and Gallagher why they needed to tell ICE where Paz Flores was going to be.
There's ways in which we're just apparently going to have to change the Trust Act to make it more trustworthy, to make sure that you are not used in those processes.
So what she's saying here, Callum, is that, you know, she doesn't believe the Trust Act was violated by the letter in this case, but that this case does exemplify why the Trust Act needs to be strengthened.
Huh. Can you explain that? So she doesn't think this was a violation in this particular case, and yet she sees an underlying concern. What is that underlying worry?
That's right. Yeah. So she's concerned about what she says was Terra Construction's brazen attempt at getting out of paying workers' comp. They didn't have workers' comp insurance at the time of the injury. And so, like we just mentioned, they called up a detective. He called his superior, who works with ICE. Ultimately, it led to the arrest of Paz Flores. Edwards says she believes that BPD's resources were abused here. She said multiple times to Commissioner Gross, I think that your force was abused here. She wants to solidify the Trust Act in a way that'll prevent similar cases in the future.
So as I was following today's hearing, I was following it through your tweets, Jen, and sitting in my – I felt like I was there. It sounded like it was a pretty tense environment. Can you bring us inside City Hall today? What was it like?
It was pretty tense. You know, there was a lot of sort of preemptive de-escalation, I'd say, some kind of niceties, if you will. So Councilman Zakim and Councilwoman Edwards, both before their questioning, led with – you know, praise for Gross and for the BPD. But then they proceeded to ask some really pointed questions of how BPD and ICE collaborate. And Gross himself said several times, you know, I'm not trying to be fresh. I'm not trying to be sarcastic. I'm just a blunt guy. And again, sort of an attempt at de-escalating anything before it sort of escalated. But that tension was palpable. Gross also, interestingly, made it really clear on multiple occasions that he was not happy with how much coverage this particular incident has received by the press. It's important to note, of course, he never said the coverage has been inaccurate. And I asked him myself afterward, you know, can you point to anything that you take particular issue with in the coverage, particularly our coverage, WBUR's coverage? And there were no inaccuracies that he pointed to. But he does say that it paints the BPD in a bad light. Let's hear from him.
I don't think the Boston Police or my brothers and sisters in law enforcement and across this Commonwealth should be the scapegoats because of what's happening in Washington, D.C. All of the arrests, homicide, murder, rape, extortion, we've been there every step of the way for the Commonwealth and especially for the city of Boston.
So Gross's major sticking point here, I mean, he was defensive. He walked in there on the defense. His major sticking point is, look, this is one incident that's being highlighted in the midst of dozens and dozens of arrests of violent criminals. And Councilwoman Edwards' response was, this is the one incident that we know about.
Right. I guess the question is whether it's the tip of the iceberg or whether it's truly a one-off situation. And,
right,
and so
exactly.
Will we then, what should we expect going forward? More hearings like this? Perhaps we'll get an answer to that question of whether it is a one-off?
I mean, perhaps. Gross did mention as well that there's a pending lawsuit. The ACLU of Massachusetts has sued the BPD and the city of Boston for better access to the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, which houses a plethora of gang database information. So that came up in today's hearing as well. Gross said, I'm not trying to be evasive, but I can't touch that. It's a lawsuit. You know, there were a lot of mention of collaboration moving forward, communication, wanting to keep the chain of communication open between city officials and BPD. As more and more of this comes up, we'll, of course, stay on top of it.
And, of course, I know that that lawsuit involving the brick was a subject of your reporting as well, and that the brick has been a subject in your reporting on an expulsion from East Boston High. So there's a lot of sort of stories coming together here
there
in this one place.
There really are. It'll be really, really interesting. We'll be busy seeing how all of this pans out over the next couple months.
All right. That's busy WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, did the state police go too far in tracking the license plates of every car that's gone into and out of Cape Cod for the past 3 years? We'll take your calls next. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's a gloomy day out, but good weather is somewhere around the corner, and for many of us, that means a trip or few to Cape Cod. You know that you have to get up early on a summer Saturday to beat the traffic there, but what you can't beat are the state police cameras that track the license plates of every vehicle crossing the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. Those cameras have been in operation every day for the last 3 years and have recorded and stored more than 100 million trips in a growing, if opaque, database. And while authorities say they use the technology to find and monitor suspects involved in drug trafficking, kidnapping, and other violent crimes, privacy advocates are concerned about how, when, and why the information is used. Wheeler Copperthwaite is a courts reporter at the Cape Cod Times. His coverage of one interesting legal case has helped bring new attention to police use of license plate readers, and he joins us now. Wheeler, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you have a problem with police tracking your license plate, or do you think concerns are completely overblown and that law enforcement agencies need to be able to track license plates to do their jobs? Where is the line between public safety and privacy? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, Wheeler, can we get into the case that you've been covering and its broader implications? There are two men in Barnstable County. They're charged with drug trafficking, and one of the two has asked the state's Supreme Judicial Court to rule on the constitutionality of evidence obtained by these Cape cameras, and that could set an important precedent. So first of all, can you explain how license plate data is collected on the Cape right now?
Of course. So there's two cameras facing – there's cameras facing on both the outbound and inbound traffic on both Sagamore and Bourne bridges. And so that traffic, any traffic coming in either direction gets captured on a camera that's maintained by the state police. That camera then takes the picture of the front of your car and the back of your car, and it does optical character recognition, or OCR, if anyone's had a PDF and done that on it, they'll know what I'm talking about. And then that turns it into a scannable piece of information. That is to say, it turns it into a piece of data that can go into a database with the date, the time, and your license plate number.
And what do we know about who's regulating the use of this data, if anybody?
So the state police is the one who, they have a fusion center in Chelsea where all this data is being stored, and they have a order that is signed called maintained by the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, but it's functionally maintained by the state police and handled by the state police. And there is a order that regulates that they get to keep it for a year, but that's about it.
And do we know who has access, Wheeler? I mean, are other law enforcement agencies besides the state police able to tap into this database?
Well, from my reporting, at the very least, Barnstable has at least one detective who is allowed to access this database. And it's not just that there's a database. There's also a thing called a hot list. And that essentially means that anytime a car comes over the bridge that's on this, quote, hot list, unquote, it will give a ping or a notification to him saying, hey, you know, we saw your car going over at this date, this time, this license plate number, here's a picture of it, sends an email to him. So at least the Barnstable police, if not other agencies, are allowed to both access the database itself as well as create notifications from active traffic going over the bridge.
And I should point out that this is not just confined to the Cape bridges. In fact, in 2011, the state government distributed $750,000 in federal grants to 43 police departments in the state to buy plate readers, with the caveat that they had to share the data with the state. So, Wheeler, do we have a sense of how widespread this kind of camera use is across the state?
You know, that's a very good question, but that's actually not something that I looked at when I was doing my story. I know that other publications have picked up on it and used it as a jumping off point, but you know, that's not something that I've done the research on.
Gotcha. And do you have a sense of how the Supreme Judicial Court might come down on this question of whether it's constitutional to use these Cape cameras as evidence?
Well, I think that there's three issues that are being appealed. The first is, essentially, does the Fourth Amendment and also, I think, the 14th article of the Massachusetts Constitution, do they say that this is an unreasonable search and seizure? And the judge in this case, he said, no, it's not an unreasonable search and seizure because the Cape cameras are in a fixed location and they don't tell anyone where you're going to be at any given point in time, like a cell phone would. Instead, they just tell you when you've come on or off the Cape. However, he did have the caveat that, and I'm quoting here, perhaps the defendant's argument will be stronger if the automatic license plate reader hot list was to issue an alert every time McCarthy's vehicle passed any of the ALPR cameras installed at a multitude of locations statewide. That would functionally put the cameras more in a class like cell phones, which track your every movement, every location. So I have no idea how the Supreme Judicial Court will rule, but it's certainly an interesting issue.
That's Wheeler Copperthwaite, a courts reporter at the Cape Cod Times. Wheeler, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, once again, a reminder that you can join our conversation. We're talking about police use of license plate trackers. And where do you see that line between public safety and privacy? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Lee leads us off. He's calling from Mashpee, so he's on the Cape. Lee, how do you see this issue? We'll try again to get Lee, but we do have Claire calling from Marlborough. Claire, what do you think about the police use of these license plate readers?
I think it's an invasion of privacy, because unlike when you cross through a toll booth where you're expecting them to take a picture of your camera and deduct money from your account, I was not aware of the cameras there. So basically, I would not go to the Cape knowing that now they're tracking. And I'd like to even know where they have other cameras so that I can avoid those areas as well. That's my point.
Got it. Claire, thank you for the call. Let's try again to get Lee in Mashpee. Lee, how do you see it?
If you have nothing to hide, what's the problem?
So you think this is an important law enforcement tool?
I certainly do. What do you want, to do nothing when people attack us every day? Information is power.
All right, we've got it. Lee and Claire, thank you both for your calls. Let's bring in two more perspectives on this. Cade Crockford directs the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts and is in our studio. Cade, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And former Boston Police Chief Daniel Linsky joins us by phone. He's now a managing director in Kroll's Security Risk Management Practice and heads the firm's Boston office. Chief, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me again. Cade, good to be on with you again.
All right, Cade, let me start with you. We just heard from two callers. Claire thinks it's a little bit too invasive. She's kind of creeped out. Lee says, you know what, if you've got nothing to hide, what's the big deal? How do you see this?
Well, there are a couple different ways that police can use license plate tracker technology. One is to try to identify in real time cars that may be stolen or cars that may be associated with registrants who have outstanding warrants or amber alerts or things of that nature. So emergency situations or, you know, somebody who may have a criminal allegation against them. That's one distinct use. What we're talking about here is something really different. It's actually dragnet surveillance. So law enforcement across Massachusetts and across the country, actually, is using license plate trackers not only to identify those stolen cars or people who may have outstanding warrants, but to collect records not on where people suspected of criminal activity have been driving, but on all of us, on people. Every single person who drives a car in the state of Massachusetts is being tracked by these license plate readers. And that is obviously problematic in a free society. We should not be tracked by the government everywhere we go simply because we have a car and we need some place to go. There's legislation at the State House right now that would bring some important regulations to the use of these tools and limit the opportunity for abuse and misuse of this information. We have supported legislation like that for many years now. This has been an issue that the ACLU has been trying to highlight and bring attention to since 2013, at least when we put out a national report on the use of license plate readers nationwide. It's something that, frankly, it's frustrating that we can't get done at the State House because the reforms are pretty common sense. They would still allow for law enforcement to conduct that real-time surveillance to find people who may have, you know, kidnapped a child or something like that. But they would impose reasonable limitations so that this information can't be, again, misused, abused, or, you know, effectively used in a way that violates core freedoms in a free society where we should expect that the government is not tracking us everywhere we go.
So, Chief Linsky, what about that line that Cade Crockford just drew for us between sort of a dragnet surveillance that gets everybody versus a more targeted approach that has maybe a look at somebody with probable cause or when there's, you know, a real emergency situation? Would you feel too confined if you could only use it in those particular cases? Do you need the full dragnet for some reason?
I think in some cases you do need the full dragnet. So, you know, how do we know the car that's going by has an Amber Alert child that's being held against their will in the vehicle? And if we capture that information and then find out an hour later that the child was kidnapped and we're able to identify the vehicle involved, if we didn't have that vehicle in the system and weren't getting that information, we wouldn't be able to follow that to where we need to go. I agree with Kate. We have to have reasonable measures on this. We have to have the length of time that this information is kept. Who can authorize it? Is there a good governance where there's a supervisor and there has to be a reason for the authorization of this information? Who can share it? And maybe we want to bring somebody outside in to maybe the ACLU or others to be the compliance program to make sure that we're following the rules. That being said, we're being tracked all the time right now. Your cell phone is tracked by your cell phone company. Google is tracking you. If you go to another state and your IP address opens up in a hotel room, it's going to start pushing out ads for the locations around that hotel room. This technology exists in the private sector. I'm no longer able to access public databases. I had a case last month where we were looking for a fugitive who was threatening a family member after conducting a homicide. And we were able to access private databases where tow trucks, transportation companies, cabs have LPR technology on it. And they're selling that data to private individuals that it can be accessed for a fee. I think the technology is there. It's out there. Private industry. I use this with clients in the in the educational space. You have a student who has a domestic violence order against somebody. We've got the subject's plate number. We're able to put them into some of the cameras around colleges and universities. That subject shows up on campus. There's an immediate alert that that person's on campus and there's a danger and a threat. So there's definitely some beneficial aspects of this technology that can help us, can save lives. I'm pretty confident it was utilized to find the young woman's body in the vehicle in Dover when she was kidnapped and murdered from our nightclubs in Boston there.
The Jesse Crane case, it's been high profile.
But Kate is very correct, and we've got to have limitations on how it's utilized and good governance to make sure that it is not abused, because it is government looking on our citizens. However, technology these days is giving everyone the ability to look on anyone they want to.
Yeah, that's absolutely a problem. And just to be clear, we at the ACLU do not appreciate the fact that companies like Vigilant Solutions and others are compiling databases containing billions and billions of records of the movements of ordinary people all across the country and then selling that information sometimes to banks or insurance companies or oftentimes to police and agencies like ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. That's a real problem. On the point about, you know, us having limited privacy generally in the 21st century, you know, we at the ACLU agree, and we think that Congress ought to deal with the problem of cell phone companies selling our location information for sure. But, you know, simply because we have a problem in one area doesn't mean that we shouldn't address it in another. So let's talk about some of those specific measures that are being proposed right now in Massachusetts to address this problem. Rep. Strauss has a bill before the legislature right now, H. 3141, which would create a state – well, actually, there already is a state repository, as you've said on this program, that the state police maintains of license plate reader data statewide. So what this bill would do is impose some limitations. It would say that instead of a year, the state police can keep that information for 121 days, and it would say that it can only share that information with external law enforcement agencies like ICE or the FBI, for example, if they have a warrant or an emergency reason for accessing the information. It would also require that law enforcement report to the legislature about really basic things: how many license plate readers exist in the state, how many pieces of license plate data exist in the database, how many times that information has actually been useful in criminal investigations. There's a separate measure that has been proposed by Rep. Hecht. That's House 3036. That would actually limit the retention period for law enforcement to 14 days, which we think is reasonable, frankly, because as Mr. Linsky said, you know, in cases where someone is murdered or kidnapped, typically we find out about that pretty soon, right away, within a couple of days. And so, you know, the 14 days period gives law enforcement the opportunity to preserve any information that they think may be relevant to a serious criminal investigation like murder or kidnapping. But beyond that, you know, part of the danger here is amassing information in a database that continues to grow and grow and grow year over year, month over month. The longer you retain that information, the more sensitive it becomes and the more dangerous it becomes in terms of abuse, misuse, and civil rights violations.
I just want to mention that we did invite the state police on our program today, but they declined our interview request. We are, however, talking about security and privacy when it comes to the state police use of tracking license plates in and out of Cape Cod. And we're talking with Cade Crockford from the ACLU of Massachusetts and former Boston Police Chief Daniel Linsky. And with you, Kevin is calling from Bourne. Kevin, this is your neighborhood. We were just talking about going over the Bourne Bridge. How do you see this issue?
I personally, you know, I travel that bridge 1,000 times every year going to and from work. And I honestly, personally, don't have an issue with it. If it can help with crime and tracking, you know, malicious intent, I think it's a good thing. I really do.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. Michaela is calling from Newton. I understand you see a little bit differently. What's your concern, Michaela?
I do hear the beneficial side of things. First of all, thank you for taking my call. But I'm concerned about how the data is stored. You hear a lot about hacking and data being misused, and I don't think it would be too hard to notice that I drive through one of those license plate readers at the same time every day. It's not too hard to put together some patterns. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, Michaela, thank you so much for the call. Chief Linsky, let me ask you about that. I know that you're not in law enforcement right now, but you're not too far removed. I mean, what was your confidence level in the security of this data? I mean, is this something that could be susceptible to hackers and then abused, even if law enforcement isn't abusing it?
anything susceptible to hackers. Although, what's the data going to tell you? That at 8:30 in the morning, this vehicle went by this particular camera at that particular time. It doesn't connect you to the registered owner of the vehicle. It's just the plate number of the vehicle. That's something that anyone with a camera could stand at the Bond Bridge and videotape cars going over all the time. What this does do is it allows law enforcement to have targeted enforcement practices. So a vehicle that goes by that's targeted and says this is a stolen vehicle, law enforcement makes a stop on that vehicle because they've got probable cause for that, as opposed to just stopping vehicles based on their observations that officers made. We've got good concrete evidence why this vehicle be shot, because it's already been determined to be in violation of the law and a danger to our safety and security. So you can actually refocus law enforcement's efforts to not be just stopping random motorists, but stopping individuals that are in violation of the law and potentially harmful to our society.
Yeah, on that specific point, I think it's important, again, to note that there are two distinct ways that police can use this technology. One is to do what you've just laid out, Mr. Linsky. The other is to create effectively a dragnet surveillance database tracking all motorists in the state. And the second thing is obviously quite different from the type of targeted enforcement you referenced. You know, to the callers who said they're not concerned because they don't have anything to hide, a couple points. We don't have any evidence of this happening in Massachusetts, frankly, because the state police have been very less than transparent about how their license plate reader system is used, who can access it, under what circumstances, how many times people have accessed it, for what reasons. But across the country, when inspectors general in other states have examined how police themselves access police databases, they have found routine violations of civil rights and routine abuses. And some of those abuses are actually just personal. So, you know, a law enforcement official who does not have any reason to worry that someone's looking over his shoulder about why he's looking up information in a database like this may feel like it's totally safe for him to query his girlfriend's license plate to see if she was really where she said she was last night. And that type of thing is exactly what we need to prevent. And these state proposals at the State House, again, Rep. Strauss's House 3141 and Rep. Heck's House 3036, would go a long way towards doing that. What we're saying at the ACLU is that we just need laws in place to keep up with the technology. This is not an attempt to take any power away from law enforcement to do what I think everybody would agree are reasonable things, like, you know, collect information about who was nearby a murder scene or access that information within a reasonable amount of time. We just want to prevent, you know, the creation of dragnet surveillance databases that, once again, really have no place in a free society. The Chinese government, for example, an authoritarian regime, uses surveillance technologies just like this one and facial recognition and other systems to keep close tabs on its population and to affect basically social and political control. These technologies enable that type of thing. In New York, the NYPD was found to have parked a license plate reader outside of a mosque. That's really troubling. That's documenting the freedom of someone to exercise their religious practice and a violation of the First Amendment. So, you know, these are the types of things that we want to avoid in Massachusetts. It's really important that the journalist on the Cape highlighted this issue. It's important that the Globe picked it up and that we're talking about it right now, because what we really need to do is just impose some guardrails, just some basic checks and balances to ensure, once again, that police can make the best use of this technology that they can for legitimate public safety purposes, but that the rest of us are protected from a dragnet surveillance regime.
Let's try to squeeze in a couple more calls before we go. Peter is on the Cape in Falmouth. Peter, what do you think?
From a law enforcement perspective, the license plate you attach to your car belongs to the state of Massachusetts. It's not yours. And driving is a privilege. And Corey, we all have to go through Corey certifications to access this information, and the guardrails are already there. And casting these dispersions on law enforcement to give this Wild West attitude is really, it's despicable. So get your facts in order and research it before the negative. We aren't out there just cleaning up the streets and this draconian measure. That's not how it's done. It's your safety. Truly, it is.
Peter, thanks for the call. Talking about the criminal background check there when he's talking about Corey. Sort of an interesting technical argument there, Chief Linsky, and I'm interested in that, pointing out that the, you know, technically the license plate is property of the DMV. And we heard a similar technical argument from David Procopio, the state police spokesman, to the Boston Globe, saying that, you know, you don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy on a public way. Is that how you see it?
That's true. Once you go on a public way, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. If you abide by the rules and regulations of the road, then you have a reasonable expectation that you won't have an interference with law enforcement as you go about your business. This technology allows law enforcement to identify somebody that has criminality and needs to be intervened with, as opposed to stopping individuals without probable cause.
So there's... Sorry, just to interject on the constitutionality point, the Supreme Court disagrees with that analysis, actually. The Supreme Court has held in a recent case, a very important recent case in June of 2018 called U.S. v. Carpenter. Chief Justice Roberts wrote this decision. That case hinged on cell phone location tracking. But in that decision, Chief Justice Roberts very clearly said that, in fact, we do retain an interest in our privacy when we are out in public going about. And he said clearly that it's a different thing for a law enforcement official to follow someone around, noting their movements, and for law enforcement to be able to access digital records collected not on one person who may be a suspect, but on every person. And that's precisely what these license plate readers are doing. So that's actually a wrong constitutional analysis.
Well, although I'm sure law enforcement would argue that there is a difference between cell phone tracking and license plates. We could go on all afternoon, but Chief and Cade, we'll have to leave it there. That's Daniel Linsky, the former Boston Police Chief and now Managing Director in Kroll's Security Risk Management Practice. Chief, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And Cade Crockford, who directs the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, researchers at Boston University say they can temporarily reverse memory decline using something called brain zapping. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. Zapping the brain with electricity can reverse the decline in memory that comes with aging. That's the conclusion of a new set of experiments, the results of which were published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Boston University researchers sent a small amount of electrical current through the brain to try to improve the working memory of older adults. And they say it worked and made the brains of 70-year-olds resemble those of 20-year-olds. We reached BU neuroscientist Rob Reinert, who led the study, for more. Rob, thanks for walking across campus to be with us.
Nice to be with you.
So your paper has shown that waves of electricity can improve working memory. Can you remind us what our working memories do for us?
So our working memory, or our immediate memory, is a space where we problem solve, reason, plan, do mathematical calculations, comprehend language. It's essentially where our consciousness lives. It's sometimes classically thought of in the field as a workbench of the human mind or a sketch pad. It's where you're actively working on information and holding that information over a period of seconds.
I feel like we talk more conversationally about short-term memory. Are they synonymous, or is there a nuanced difference there?
Yeah, they're very similar, but these days among psychologists and neuroscientists, we typically refer to this system that holds information over brief periods, over the period of seconds, as a working memory, because of insights in the field over the past decades that have shown this is really a space where we work with information, not just hold it in a static way across time.
So can you explain a little bit about how your experiment works, right? So you've got this group, you've got 42 young adults in their 20s, you've got 42 in their 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. They put on these sort of skull caps, right, that have electrodes on them, and then you have them do what?
You come into the lab, we attach electrodes, which are embedded into a nylon cap, like a swimmer's cap. And also embedded in this cap are electrodes that deliver electrical current. So there's electrodes that just monitor brain waves and electrodes that deliver electrical current to your brain at extremely weak and safe levels. And then once the cap is set up, you move into our booth where you play essentially a video game. In this case, a video game that taps your working memory, and the current is delivered over the first 25 minutes.
Would you even feel it on your head, Rob, or is it imperceptible?
You barely feel it. So it's 1.5 milliamps of stimulation intensity. To give you a sense for how weak that is, a standard 9-volt battery has a voltage drain of 15 milliamps. So it's an order of magnitude weaker than a standard 9-volt battery, extremely weak. What you feel is a slight itching, tingling, or poking sensation nearest the electrodes. But that only lasts for about 30 seconds, and then people's skin habituates to that tingling sensation, and then you feel nothing for the remainder of the 25-minute session.
I see. And so they're playing this game that you were talking about, and how does that go?
So you play this game where you're presented with a real-world natural object, like a scene or a face, very briefly, and then it goes away, nothing's on the screen, and you're instructed to hold that picture that you just saw on the computer screen over a delay period, which is about 3 seconds. Then it's presented with the exact same image or a slightly modified version of that image, and you just indicate whether it's the same image you saw originally or a different one. And so it really requires that you hold a very like high fidelity, highly precise image of that natural object in your working memory over a period of 3 seconds, and then tell us whether it's the same object or not.
I see.
It's a classic working memory task.
And I understand that this wasn't just the same frequency for everybody, that you somehow tuned the current to people's individual brain waves. Is that right? And how did you do that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. That was a really novel piece of our brain stimulation protocol. It's individually customized. So so these two brain areas, in the prefrontal areas and the temporal area of the brain, they're synchronized, or their brain activity is correlated, and they're correlated at a particular frequency. Yours might be 7.6, mine might be 8.2. hertz or cycles per second, and we find that sweet spot in your brain network, and then we tune the stimulator to that exact frequency, which we then try to isolate this particular working memory brain network, knowing its preferred frequency.
I see. So everybody has been tuned, they're strapped in, they're playing their game, and then what did you find about how they performed?
So we found that at baseline, before the brain stimulation, the older people in our study, 60 or 70 years old, had working memory deficits. They were performing slower and less accurately on our working memory task, which is consistent with decades of research prior, relative to 20-year-olds who were also a part of this study. However, after we used electrical brain stimulation that was frequency tuned to their specific brain network dynamics, we could more tightly synchronize these brain networks, make them better connected and correlated, and then as a result, boost working memory performance in these older individuals. In fact, boost it so great that they were now comparable in terms of their working memory performance to the 20-year-olds.
And you found that that effect lasted for the duration of your 50-minute experiment, but then it sort of ends. So I'm curious if you know how long it could expect to last after that, because I'm sure you're already getting those phone calls and emails from people hoping that this might be a commercial therapy at some point. And they're wondering, you know, are we talking about, you know, a few zaps in the morning and it's going to last me all day, or would I need some kind of recurring dose of electricity multiple times a day?
Right. It's a great question. We're always interested in next steps. Many of the previous studies have just shown online improvements, so improvements in behavior that occur just while stimulation is on. But we're actually finding, surprisingly, that we can turn the stimulator off and see these effects last for at least 50 minutes after the stimulator is off. So these are after effects lasting at least 50 minutes, almost 1 hour. But that's actually just when the experiment ended. And based on our previous work that have seen after effects lasting hours, but definitely need to do the proper experiments to find out exactly how long the effects last. When do they come back down to baseline levels?
What kinds of risks or obstacles could you see that might stop something like this from becoming a commercial therapy?
Going to the market with it, I'm less knowledgeable about, but I would imagine miniaturizing. There'd have to be developments in the technology itself, making it less bulky, miniaturized, wearable, and so on. Certainly before that, this is just a proof of principle study. So we need to do much more basic science in establishing the findings and then porting it over to clinical groups, people with variety of brain disorders, such as pathological brain disorders like Alzheimer's and related dementias, to see if this could actually help people in a real-world setting.
And to see if it's safe, right? I'm sure the FDA would want to give it some heavy scrutiny.
Absolutely. Should point out, this is one of the safest ways to non-invasively stimulate the brain. So there's a variety of techniques and this type of current, which is different from, in a very important way, from electroshock therapy, which people are familiar with. It's very different from magnetic stimulation. The type of stimulation we're using is electric, and it's orders of magnitude weaker. So it's incredibly weak, safe technique to non-invasively stimulate the brain. And as a result, you don't see adverse effects. I've recorded thousands of participants now over the past several years, and the most severe adverse effect, you can call it that, is a slight tickling or itching sensation under the electrodes. We don't see side effects as you might see in a transcranial magnetic stimulation study or certainly an electroshock therapy study.
Well, I'm sure there's no shortage of life sciences companies looking for chances to bear that out in clinical trials. Yeah. That's Rob Reinhart, assistant professor at Boston University's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. Professor, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, Chris Siderick, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Team Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers with a quick score check before we go. It's 5-2 Blue Jays over the Red Sox in their home opener at Fenway Park. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.